The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome back to the program today Professor Keith Dowt. He joins us in studio, and he is the co-author of a new book called Ethnic and National Identity in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
You are deeply interested in a particular part of the world. How did this happen?
Well, it started when the war was occurring in 1992, 1993. I was living in Missouri, and I'd listen to radio broadcasts, and I'd read the New York Times, and I'd ask myself, how can this be happening? Why is the world kind of passive? They're letting an apartheid state be created in Southeast Europe. And so I'd start talking about the subject in my classes, and it became kind of a joke among students. And I said, where is there an example of this? And students would say, Bosnia. So then I started going to conferences, organized conferences. I went to two conferences in Bosnia. Then I had a Fulbright at the Faculty of Political Science. And I just keep going back. I have good colleagues and friends there. It's a good place to be a sociologist. I think Bosnia does more for sociology than sociology does for Bosnia.
Some of our listeners probably aren't aware of the history. What happened to Yugoslavia?
Well, Yugoslavia was seen as a good place, positive place, healthy place to live. Of course, it wasn't perfect, but they had a polyethnic society. And after World War II, the partisans were very proud of having defeated nationalism, and they created a socialist communist country that was very popular among leftist intellectuals in Europe and the United States. And there was openness. Tito was leader of the, third line countries. And so what happened was after Tito died, there wasn't a transition prepared, and nationalism grew stronger and stronger among the Serbian nationalists and Croatian nationalists. And Bosnia was kind of caught between the two. And you can resist your enemy by being different than your enemy, or in some cases you become like your enemy when you resist. So nationalism occurred among Bosniaks as well. And there was a lot of confusion in the sense the Yugoslav army, is it fighting for Yugoslavia or is it fighting for Greater Serbia? And so they played both sides of the picture, and people were caught. And so because people were so closely interconnected, at least in Bosnia, it took a lot of violence to separate them and divide the communities.
All right. So the country known as Yugoslavia fell apart. Regions broke away and declared independence. Tell our listeners what these regions are and how they're different.
Yugoslavia means like South Slav country, right? So Croatia, Serbia, all the countries are South Slavs. Except, just the Kosovo Albanians, right? So now imagine Texas separating from the United States and becoming its own country, California separating, becoming its own country. A similar kind of succession wars occurred in the sense that first Slovenia became an independent nation state, and then Croatia, and then Serbia, then Montenegro, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. And so they went for the nation state model, right? A nation based on one ethnicity, whereas Yugoslavia had been a plurality of ethnicities, and it held together a kind of different kind of society, a different kind of community, which kind of had to be destroyed and killed in order that these nationalistic nation states could be created.
And the nation states are?
There's Croatia, there's Slovenia, there's Serbia, there's Bosnia-Herzegovina, there's Macedonia, there's Montenegro, and there's Kosovo.
And how are they different?
The ethnicity is complex in the Balkans, right? Racially, there's the same, South Slavs. Basically, the ethnicities are distinguished by faith traditions. Typically, you would say in Croatia are Catholics, right? In Serbia, there's Orthodox, Serbian Orthodox, right? In Bosnia, there were all three. There are Catholics, Bosnian Serbs, Bosnian Muslims, or Croats, Serbs, and Bosniaks. So in some ways, Bosnia was a model for all of Yugoslavia in terms of what a polyethnic society is. Now, during communism, religion was kind of in the home and in the back region. It kind of took backstage. And after Tito died, religion sort of stepped up, became politically engaged in the community, and became the vanguard in some cases and in order to create nationalisms and nation states. So now each – there's shared cultural traditions as South Slavs, and also each community, Croat, Serb, Bosniak, have distinctive traditions. They're often shared and interchanged, particularly in Bosnia. Say in Sarajevo, I often heard people say on Christmas Eve, all Bosnians, Muslims, Croats, Serbs would go to the Christmas Eve service. There was a Catholic church in Sarajevo where there was a prayer room for Muslims, right? And let's not forget there's also Bosnian Jews next up. And also it's not also clear-cut. For example, in the sense that 500,000 Muslims, Bosniaks, live in Serbia, right? Many Serbs lived in Croatia, and they were kind of purged during these wars and forced to go to Kosovo or Serbia or Bosnia, Republika Srpska.
My guest is Keith Dowt, and this is the Book Nook. Okay, more of the history lesson. Bosnia, the majority is Muslim, the Bosniaks, as you call them. You've got a big population of Croats. You've got a big population of Serbs there, but they're not the majority. What happened during the war in Bosnia?
Yeah. It's often presented that the Bosnian Muslims are the majority, but that's not actually the case. Maybe they're 45%. It may vary. Keep in mind, a lot of people are leaving Bosnia now, particularly younger people, and that's also true in Serbia and Croatia. So I would say about 40% Bosnian Muslims, then maybe 20-25% Serbian Orthodox, and then a smaller percentage Bosnian Catholics or Croats. There are other minorities. There's Roma. There's Bosnian Jews. A lot of people from Albania live in Bosnia. So it's a diverse society. It's a plurality of ethnicities. But there's also a lot held in common in terms of culture and history.
All right. So you've written extensively about the region. What made you decide to write this new book, Ethnic and National Identity in Bosnia-Herzegovina? What were you trying to prove?
Oh, that's a good question, a hard question. What initiated it was basically my co-author, Adnan Tufekicic. So we'd been publishing articles and in different journals, and Adnan said, Keith, why don't we do a book together? And I thought, oh, no, another book. But I thought, yeah, that's a great idea. So we had our articles, and rather we stopped sending them to journals to be published, and we compiled them and tied them together as a book. And I was really happy to do this, to work with Adnan and co-author the chapters together. And we sort of fit seamlessly as we narrated the accounts. One purpose of the book is to show how there is a commonality in Bosnia, a national identity in Bosnia that's not recognized or understood or appreciated by the international community and also political leaders in Bosnia and around Bosnia. So they say, well, Serbia has a national identity, Croatia has a national identity, but Bosnia doesn't because there's no majority ethnic group. But we try to show how, if you think of it in another way, that there is a national identity when you look at the kinship structures. So without being overtly political, we're trying to demonstrate empirically and scientifically, looking through the kinship patterns and how they're interconnected, how there is a national identity, and the character and substance of these kinship patterns provide for the distinctiveness of the Bosnian social character.
Okay, I'm going to speak for the listeners out there who don't know what a kinship structure or a kinship pattern is. What does that mean?
Well, I myself am not an anthropologist, but anthropologists would talk about different kinship structures. One could be blood or agnatic, right? So following that. Another could be in-lawship or affines, right? Another could be ritual or fictive kinship, like sorority brothers and sisters. It's kind of a fictive kinship. So these are three types of kinships. And in this book, we look at and examine all three, focusing in particular on in-lawship, but but also fictive kinship. So the different names, they're sophisticated, they're complex. For example, for in-lawship, there are many, many words to describe the different relations you have to your in-laws. My mother-in-law, my father-in-law, my wife's brother, my father's brother, their children. There's a distinct name for each of those roles or kinship relationships. So there's kind of a system there where they know each other, and it kind of affirms the importance of in-lawship in the community.
So what did these patterns demonstrate to you?
Well, for me, the epiphany, the thing that we learned was that there are ethnographers who went to Serbia and studied kinship as well, and there are two anthropologists who went to Bosnia and studied kinship. And I studied those books carefully. And what emerged for me was that there's a distinct – in Bosnia, in-lawship, kinship by marriage has importance, status, and prestige. The name for it is prijatelji, which is also the word for friends. But after a marriage, it's important for families to come together and form strong bonds or in-lawship. So we asked a survey question of a representative sample. How often do the parents of the husband and the parents of the wife come together for a party or a celebration or a gathering or religious things? Now, this is not like my wife and I visiting her parents or my wife and I visiting my parents. This is when her parents and my parents come together and have a picnic or a celebration or occasion. So the answer was 10 or more times. And the person I worked with said, oh, that's not enough. It should be higher, 20 or so. So our survey data showed that this relationship was important and carried out in practice. Now, the Yugoslav ethnologist said that this kinship was not so important in Serbia, that in Serbia there was another kinship called would be like godfather, or the word for it is kumstvov. And so like the best man – or the witness at a wedding, or the witness at a baptism, and that this relationship has a lot of prestige and status. So if you want to be a righteous, moral person in the community, or appear to be, you show that you're a good godfather in Serbia. Whereas in Bosnia, the status and the prestige comes from having strong in-lawships and respecting those relations. So I think the character of these two kinship structures provide for the distinct national identities. Bosnia is known for not being xenophobic, being open. And I think that's because – I mean, other countries are not xenophobic either. But Bosnia has this sense of openness, and my sense is that it derives from this kinship structure that forms the community and builds the social character of people in Bosnia. And the finding is that this in-lawship is important to all ethnic groups – Croat, Serb, and Bosniak.
Would it be a gross generalization to say that Serbia and Croatia tend to be more patriarchal than Bosnia?
That is true because it focuses on the bloodline, the agnatic line, right? And so that's true. I'm not saying there's patriarchy in Bosnia too, of course. But as I talked not just about the in-lawship but also elopement, yeah, I think as a generalization, I think that could be true, but I'm sure there's some very fine patriarchs in Bosnia as well. But I think the culture favors patriarchy less than, say, in Bosnia, in Serbia and Croatia.
In case you're just tuning in, you're listening to 91.3 WYSO, your home for independent news and handpicked music. It's the Book Nook. My guest is Dr. Keith Dowt, returning to the program. He is a professor at Wittenberg, and his new book, co-written with Adnan Tufekcic, Ethnic and National Identity in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Last time you were on the show was for your book about elopement. This is a very interesting aspect of Bosnia. Let's talk about elopement. What does that mean?
Well, in Bosnia, there are different marriage customs. In Bosnia, a marriage custom that is more common than people like to think, even in Bosnia, is that there may be a love of two young people. Rather than pay for a wedding, rather than go through the whole ritual of a big wedding celebration, when the couple, the boyfriend and girlfriend, decide let's get married, In the evening, they'll go to the girl's house and she'll go through the window or out the door without her parents knowing, or perhaps just with her parents ignoring this, because then they don't have to pay for the wedding. And she goes to his parents' house and voila, they're married. A couple weeks later, they might get a marriage license. Now, in Bosnia, I've been told that every family has an elopement story. Oh, do you remember when my aunt eloped and married Uncle so-and-so? So every family has an elopement story. And now, two anthropologists studied this marriage custom, William Lockwood in Michigan and Tone Bringa, a Norwegian anthropologist, and they observed it as well. But they studied just two villages in central Bosnia, and they observed it. So is this custom true for all of Bosnia? And this is the advantage of the survey I did, the representative survey. It was a random cluster stratified sampling, and the sample size was almost 2,000. And so we can trust the samples representative of the population. And as you see in the book, a hot 25, 30% of the marriages were created or established through elopement.
I really like the section about the shrines. And you're in this little village, and there's this, seems like a fairly ancient shrine in this village. Mm-hmm. And these young men walked by and they told you, put money there, put money there.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about these shrines. Yeah. What's the purpose and what do they represent?
Yeah. Well, this is a unique area in near Tuzla in Bosnia. And Adnan and I went there to these villages. And in each of these villages, there's what's called a turbe, which is like a mausoleum. So turbe is the Turkish word for mausoleum. And in the turbe is buried a notable figure, right, from the Ottoman period in the 16th, 17th century, right? Now, one kinship is when two people are friends and maybe they drink each other's blood and they become like blood brothers by ritual rather than by fact, but they become very tight. Now, in Bosnia, these ritual kinships are often formed by people from different ethnic groups, that this is a way to create solidarity in the society in the sense that you're close to your bloodline, but you also connect with others in the society in deep ways through this ritualized friendship. So the first village we went to, there's the mausoleum, and then there's a very prominent grave next to it. And they say there that's the Popro's grave, and that's the grave for the blood brother or ritualized blood brother. And they say he's a Serbian Orthodox. He's a Bosnian Orthodox. And there's stories and folklore about how the Ottoman figure and this Bosnian Serb, became close friends. And when they died, they wanted to be buried together or close to each other. And so when the Ottoman official died, he said, when I die, the custom is to put money in the turbe where he's buried. You put money in my grave on my turbe, also put it on my blood brother's, my Popro's grave as well, the Orthodox. And this what was so interesting was this famous Yugoslav ethnographer, Milenko Filipovic, went there and reported this story. And his article hadn't been translated and published, and so we translated it and published it. And so he tells this story, and sure enough, as we were standing there, these youths coming home from school walked by and say, throw money in, because they know after we do, they can come back and get the money. And then there's this other village, not far, about 20 kilometers away, and there's also a Muslim torbe there. And we met with people there, and this older man told us a kind of similar story about how an Orthodox and a Muslim were very, very close friends, very close, closer than any other kind of kinship. And they said, when we die, we want to be together, right? So the Muslim died, but the Orthodox man was late to the funeral. But when he got there, just as they were saying prayer, he died.
Mm-hmm.
And so they buried them together in the same torbe.
Mm.
And the man who told us the story said, I heard this from my parents. My parents heard it from their parents. So this story about the closeness of their friendship is being told through generations. And he opened the torbe and showed it to us, and we saw the two graves next to each other. Now, what was special for me here was a close friend from Harvard, Tom Butler, who was a Slavic professor, also visited this site and wrote an article in Bosnian on it that was published in Bosnia. So I felt as if Adnan and I were following in the footsteps of people before us. We followed Milenko Filipovic and then Tom Butler there. So we were following their tradition and were equally amazed by the kind of what we called the blending of traditions in this manner, and how whether it exists in political reality or today in modern times, it's part of the folklore that forms the culture of the society and the identity of the society.
Did you and Adnan leave money when they told you to?
I'm trying to remember.
I'll bet you your friend Tom left money.
I don't know.
Okay, you don't remember, huh? Adnan said, no, don't leave money. They'll take it. I bet you left money. Come on. I bet you left a couple marks there, didn't
you? We were with the whole group. I'm trying to think of the other one.
Okay. Didn't mean to put you on the spot. I just figured.
The first one, yes, but we were such a crowd at the second one, it would have just been kind of awkward. Uh-huh. But two young men on motorcycles, very cool, modern, hip guys came up, and they walked up. They asked permission from the imam to go, and they gave money.
Uh-huh.
So honestly, probably not. I'm cheap.
Okay. It's a way, though, of the culture, the society is honoring these kinds of blood relationships between different ethnicities. And in a way, the war in Bosnia really fractured and destroyed a lot of this feeling, didn't it?
Exactly. I mean, it's special. We're looking for its resilience. And our book is trying to bear witness to this heritage and also point to the importance of its resilience. And we're kind of resisting nationalist accounts of Bosnia, which say this culture is dead or never existed or is unimportant. We're saying it is important and needs to continue to be honored. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
In case you're just tuning in, my guest is Keith Dowt. He is the co-author of Ethnic and National Identity in Bosnia, Herzegovina, Kinship and Solidarity in a Polyethnic Society. It has been almost a quarter of a century since they had those meetings just down the road at Wright-Patterson. Richard Holbrooke was down there, Slobodan Milosevic, all the leaders from these three countries, Croatia, Bosnia, and Serbia, together with Holbrooke, and they put together the Dayton Peace Accords. And I think if we did a survey here in the Dayton area and we asked people if they had a positive or a negative opinion of the Dayton Peace Accords or no opinion, I think the majority would say that they have a positive opinion. Mm. What do you think about the Dayton Peace Accords? How do you feel about them?
Well, I'm going to say yes and no. The Dayton Peace Accords is positive because it stopped the war. And it looked like nothing could stop the war. And Richard Holbrooke stopped the war. And that was a great thing, a diplomatic achievement that deserves respect and to be honored. But the Dayton Peace Accord, I'll use two metaphors to describe it. One, because it reifies ethnicity and you have three presidents. And if you're a Bosnian Jew or a Bosnian Roma, you can't be in the federal parliament and you can't be president of the country. So you're excluded because you don't have the right ethnicity, right? And those two people, a Bosnian Jew and Bosnian Roma, have sued successfully at the World Court to have the Dayton Peace Accords changed because it violates their human rights. So the Dayton Peace Accords sort of perpetuates and plays into the hands of the nationalists. Okay, I think if any country had to live under the Dayton Peace Accords, it would go crazy. The government wouldn't be able to do anything, whether it be Norway, United States, Canada, or Mexico. If their constitution was like the Dayton Peace Accords, the country would sort of dissolve. So the Dayton Peace Accords is kind of like a straitjacket in my mind. Okay, every time Bosnians try to move, it tightens, becomes very painful. And so the only rational choice is not to move at all, which is why the situation in Bosnia is stagnant and regressing now, because this Dayton Peace Accords is basically like a straitjacket. So while the Dayton Peace Accords stopped the war, it became like a kind of Trojan horse in the sense they led it into the country, into the city, and the nationalists were inside, and they came out, and now they are killing Bosnia, not the war. They're not using weapons to kill Bosnia, but they're using the Dayton Peace Accords to kill Bosnia. And so it's hard to see how Bosnia is going to survive as Bosnia as long as the Dayton Peace Accord remains the constitution. So Republika Srpska, the nationalist leaders, went to succeed. Bosnian Croats went to succeed. And they're using the rhetoric and narrative of the Dayton Peace Accords to justify these political interests.
When you say it's killing Bosnia, what do you mean?
Well, it favors the nationalist leaders whose interest is not in the country itself, but in their own political parties. It prevents a positive sense of unity and social integration. It sort of shuts out serious, genuine reconciliation. Reconciliation occurs, but always from the ground up or through NGOs. It discourages a state that looks after the good of society itself. It creates political parties that serve the selfish interests of different ethnic groups and monopolize the power such that voices interested in a polyethnic society and the commonality of the country and that heritage are kind of snuffed out.
Could Bosnia join the European Union?
Well, one problem in terms of getting into the European Union, I'm not a political scientist and don't follow this real carefully, but if there are Bosnian Jews and Bosnian Roma who don't have the political right to hold office, Bosnia is not going to get into the Dayton Peace Accords. Now, they won the suit many years ago, and so as long as the nationalist politicians don't change this aspect of the Constitution, they won't get into Europe. And the nationalist Serb leaders don't want to go into Europe, and so they don't want Bosnia to join Europe because that would take – they'd lose power.
Is it because the Serbs are aligned with Russia?
Russia has become more and more of a player. The United States has become less and less of a player in the region. And Russia's connections with Serbia are strong and growing, right? And it's hard to see how the Dayton Peace Accords are going to last, right? So that's true. One, as a kind of reaction formation, Bosniaks, the nationalist leaders for Bosnian Muslims, are developing and strengthening their relationships to Turkey. When I was there, Erdogan, the president of Turkey, came and campaigned in Bosnia. And so each ethnic group is looking for support outside of Bosnia. The Bosniaks aligned with Turkey. The Serbs aligned with Russia. And the Croats with Germany.
Oh. Yeah?
And so these countries, Germany, Turkey, and Russia, are like the big brothers. And frankly, only the United States continues to argue, defend, and support, perhaps idealistically, perhaps realistically, that Bosnia's future is best as a polyethnic society which respects its heritage.
Well, the more things change, the more they stay the same. It's a fascinating region, and to look back at the arc of history, as you do in this book, and to see the culture, it's a real eye-opener. Keith, we really appreciate your time today.
Thank you. I was really happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
My guest has been Keith Dowd. He's the co-author, along with Adnan Tufekcic, of Ethnic and National Identity in Bosnia-Herzegovina, Kinship and Solidarity in a Polyethnic Society. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for tuning in.